for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Interpol issued red notice arrest warrants for Gaddafi. He's wanted for alleged crimes against humanity. Iran's President Ahmadinejad called for an end to the Syrian crackdown, and the German court backed that country's plans to help bail out its European neighbors. Joining me in the studio for the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, David Ignatius of the Washington Post, Elise Labatt of CNN, and we welcome Edward McBride of The Economist. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And good to see you all. Good morning to
you. Good morning, Diane.
I must say, even before mentioning our phone number, I'd like to hear your thoughts, David, on this threat that has been issued, which is said to have been, what, confirmed but not verified, or what's the language being used?
It means it's in the intermediate stage where it's something that intelligence officials feel they have to take seriously, that it comes from credible channels, but they don't yet know the substance of it. Just to give listeners a little bit of background, this threat is said to involve threats against Washington and New York, and or New York, timed to the 10th anniversary of 9/11, and is said to involve car or truck bombs that would be used to carry explosives. That's awfully thin material, and I haven't gotten any indication that there's more substance yet, although people are looking. The intelligence agencies for the past month have been pulsing every channel around the world, contacting every intelligence liaison service with which the U.S. has contact, going to every channel. The FBI has been doing the same thing with its network of informants throughout the country, just asking about any anomalous detail. Have you heard anything? Is there anything new? So that's generated an awful lot of information that they've been checking down. I don't know whether this latest threat comes out of that process of just trying to pulse. But even a week ago, the word that I was getting from my intelligence contacts was that as of that time, they had no evidence of a credible plot in motion toward the U.S. So something changed.
And this morning on the Today program, Elise, Vice President Biden said that a trusted source in Pakistan picked up the word that three people from that country planned to fly to the U.S., but the information included little about specifics.
It's very unclear whether it's just from a trusted source. There's some word that perhaps it could be some kind of intercepts or something like that. Clearly, over the last several months, leading up to the bin Laden raid and Abbottabad, and after that, the U.S. knew that Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda, was trying to plan some kind of attack along the lines leading up to 9/11. So as David said, that they've been really getting ready for this, really prepared for listening to these kind of channels. We're not really clear who this trusted source is. Even the Pakistani sources I spoke to today are being very mum, saying for security concerns. It's unclear whether the Pakistanis themselves led the U.S. to this information, whether it's another source that the U.S. had. But we also know that in recent days, and we'll talk about it later, the Pakistanis nabbed three al-Qaeda senior operatives with help from the United States. Not so clear whether that information came from these arrests.
The other question, Edward, becomes what do people make of that information? What behavior, what changes in behavior, what is our thinking?
Well, the official line is we do absolutely nothing different from what we were doing before. I saw Mayor Bloomberg standing up at a press conference saying just that, you know, he assured New Yorkers that the authorities were doing things sort of seen and unseen to try and respond to this very vague threat, but that New Yorkers should go about their business as usual. And of course, you'd expect him and others to say that, but I think that's right. The problem is that the information is so vague, at least what's been made public, that it's very hard to somehow frame an appropriate response. So, as usual, we would have to trust that the authorities are on top of this and leave
hope
it to
for
them.
The best.
Exactly.
At least going back to the arrest of the three Al-Qaeda operatives, had those men been planning attacks on the U.S. and other Western targets?
Well, the operating assumption is that they were. Again, we don't know specifically what the plans were, but clearly these were senior Al-Qaeda operatives that were planning attacks against the homeland. And I have to say, given the last several months, even leading back to January, where the relationship with the Pakistanis were so bad, and we really thought it was, and we've talked about it many times on this show, that it's to the point of no return. The U.S. and the Pakistanis are really hailing this as very sewn-up intelligence cooperation.
Cooperation.
Exactly, exactly. That the United States gave the Pakistanis information that led to this arrest. There's always been these kind of complaints that the Pakistanis would then take this information, tip off the informants. The thing is, this was someone that the U.S. wanted arrested. These were some people that the Pakistanis wanted arrested. Sometimes those interests don't always converge. This time they did, and they're really hailing that cooperation.
Elise is right in the atmospherics that surrounded these arrests. My only caution would be that things are never quite as bad as they seem in the period when supposedly relations between the CIA and the ISI have ruptured, and they're never as good as they seem when they want to claim joint success. This is still a very fraught relationship. The Pakistanis, knowing that they were in the doghouse with the U.S., had been trying to come up with some counterterrorism achievement. I mean, I heard this weeks ago that they were saying, we're really out there, CIA brothers and sisters, and we're going to try to do something important. And so along comes this operation. And I think they wanted to show that they were still reliable allies. But how deep it goes is another question.
What about this double suicide bombing, David?
Well, it took place in Quetta, the same place that the operation that took out the Al-Qaeda figures went down. Quetta is a very tough place for the ISI to operate. It's a big, densely populated city in southwest Pakistan, into which have flowed tens of thousands of Afghan refugees. So it's a perfect hiding place. The suicide bombers went after the local chief of the Frontier Corps. The Frontier Corps is the instrument that Pakistan and the U.S. would like to see reestablish order in the tribal areas. So in a sense, it was a very direct response to somebody who figures large in our plans for stability. But beyond that, it's hard to know what the MO was here.
David Ignatius, he's a columnist for The Washington Post. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Edward, European stock markets fell to their lowest level in 2 years. What's going on?
Well, it's all part of this actually two-year-long sort of slow-motion crisis that's been going on in Europe, stemming from the sovereign debt of countries originally like Greece, and then you added Portugal and Ireland, and now maybe Italy and Spain. This sense that European governments, the more profligate ones, are going bust, that the economy is slowing down in Europe, and that's making it even harder for them to balance their books. They're dragging their feet anyway over trying to make cutbacks. And the countries that have been helping them out thus far in Northern Europe, notably Germany, are getting very tired of doing that. And even though things seem to be patched up every now and again. Every few months, the EU leaders come together and they announce a great deal. There's a sense, and it's growing again, that the deals are never quite adequate, that the issues aren't really resolved, and that Europe doesn't really know how to fix this problem.
What about these recent jury decisions, court decisions, saying that Germany could go forward, should go forward with the bailout?
Well, that sort of encapsulates the problem. On the one hand, if you think the bailouts are a good thing, then the court decision was a good one, right? It said that what Germany had been doing so far was fine. It did say that the German government should be getting parliamentary approval for the money it's offering to its friends in Southern Europe. But it basically gave the German government the go-ahead. The problem is that the court order also implied that some of the long-term solutions that people have been discussing for this problem, for example, for all the countries in Europe to collectively issue bonds, which would be guaranteed by all of them, which in effect means guaranteed by the strongest financially, i.e. Germany, that was something that probably wouldn't be legal and would require changes in German law. And that just highlights how short term, sure, European governments can come up with a bit of money and try and patch things over. But in the long run, they don't have any solution for the problem of countries overspending and the problems that brings.
So it was a confusing decision, David.
Well, it wasn't a decisive resolution of the problem. The markets responded very favorably because it seemed to open the door to the kind of rescue that they'd like to see. I think, as Ed said, what we're watching is a slow-motion car wreck that has been going on now for more than a year. This is a week in which you saw their essentials, I think, begin to come into play. The Dutch Prime Minister said to the Greeks, either you submit to our fiscal demands or you leave the euro.
David,
and that's what
David
it's coming
Nash
down to.
The Washington Post short break. We'll be right back. And the question, picking up on this European financial system, is Europe headed for another recession, David?
Well, Diane, the fundamental problems in Europe are so severe that I think there's much worse ahead. Countries like Greece are going to be driven into a recession by the austerity measures that are being required. I mean, Chancellor Angela Merkel said something really interesting this week. She was speaking frankly, voicing what most Germans feel when she said, Greeks shouldn't get pensions before Germans do. In other words, the people we're bailing out with our hard-earned money and all of our industrious labor shouldn't get an easy free ride. And that sentiment is spreading in Germany and Northern Europe. And so I think the question really is, it either submit to the dictates of some kind of central European fiscal authority and accept their demands for budget austerity or leave the euro. You can't have it both ways.
And what about the Swiss central bank putting a ceiling on the franc's appreciation against the euro?
Well, basically, all these banks wanted to
kind of a bit, you know, there was a real fear that they were going to abandon the euro in favor of the Swiss franc, which has always been a very stable currency, not quite at the euro, but very close. And so there was a lot of fear that, you know, bond prices would rise. And so what they did was they set a limit at the Swiss franc. And as, you know, David was just saying, now the Swiss are paying the price for this. The value of the currency depreciated about 9%. And so this is the problem when all of these countries try, the bigger countries are trying to bail out the other ones. It's not just about, you know, the pensioners. It's going to make it more expensive for Germany and other countries to borrow money to help Greece and these other countries to pay off their debts.
And what about Italy, Edward?
Well, Italy, two days ago it was, the Italian Senate passed the latest austerity package. Italy, like all these other countries with budgetary problems, is promising furiously to fix them and cut back. That package is due very shortly to go before the lower house of the Italian parliament. I think things will be a little closer there, but the assumption seems to be that it'll pass. But the problem for all these countries is that these austerity measures, as David suggested, actually make their economies worse. Of course, if you have huge cutbacks in government spending, there's less money in the economy. If the economy sours, then, of course, the governments have worse problems with their budgets. And, you know, so you get into this downward spiral. And that seems to be the risk in Italy and Spain. That's already happened in Greece. The economy there is contracting by, I think it's 7%. You know? So that's the fear, that by pursuing the measures that are supposedly going to help with their budgets, they'll actually send themselves into a recession.
And then there's the political problem that these leaders are facing. I mean, as if Italian Prime Minister Berlusconi didn't have enough problems. He's kind of getting himself into some more trouble with things that he's saying about Italy. But also these austerity measures, while, you know, seen as, on one hand, he's being criticized for not doing enough to mitigate the problem. At the same time, there are strikes, tens of thousands of people in the streets that are not favoring these austerity measures. And we've seen that all throughout Europe. We saw it several months ago in Britain. We've seen it in many other countries. While not being accused of doing enough, when they do too much, they face political problems.
All right, let's talk about Libya and the question everyone is asking, where is Muammar Gaddafi? David.
Well, the answer from WAMU headquarters is we don't know.
We don't know.
And there's an awful lot of effort obviously going into looking for him. The assumption is that he's in the tribal areas in central south Libya, where his tribal base has been, but nobody really knows that either.
What about those convoys to Niger?
What we do know is that Libyan convoys, and there are different reports about how many vehicles cross the border into Niger. The most worrying report that I've heard doesn't involve Gaddafi, but involves heat-seeking missiles. A New York Times reporter this week, in the chaos of Libya, stumbled across 10 empty crates of SAM missiles that had been shipped to Libya from Moscow. It is believed that a total of over 4,000 missiles were shipped by the Russians. The reporter happened to stumble across the empty crates. And the reports that I've heard are that some of these missiles may be transiting out of Libya in the hands of extremists, Islamic extremists, who could use them for real malice, and that's got people scared.
Actually, it was a group of reporters, including CNN, and we basically were taken to the site by Human Rights Watch and other groups who saw. Basically, Libya had for a country that doesn't produce missiles itself, it has one of the largest stockpiles of surface-to-air missiles, and these are the kind of shoulder-fired missiles that are feared by the international community because they can be used at aircraft. And 20,000 is a lot for a country that's not producing them. There is no real accounting of where they are. The U.S., other NATO countries have been trying to get with the Libyan NTC for some time to try and secure these. But with chaos in the country, there is a fear that they've been certainly they've been looted. Don't know if the rebels have them. Don't know where they are. They could, a lot are believed to have gone across the border. And there is a genuine fear that in this chaos, Al-Qaeda and the Maghreb could get their hands on
them. And, of course, Libya also has a stockpile of chemical weapons, Edward.
That's right. And Libya used chemical weapons once, you know, which is obviously not a very pleasant precedent in the civil war in Chad when its forces were involved there. Those chemical weapons stockpiles, which were very big, had been drawn down, well, not drawn down, but eliminated over the years, partially thanks to Gaddafi's agreement with the U.S. and other countries to eliminate his weapons of mass destruction. But they hadn't been completely eradicated, and they're stock still missing. And of course, that's one of the first things that the U.S. and others would like to see secured, and something the NTC says it's doing, but reports are so confused that it's hard to know what's going
on. We're talking about 11 tons of mustard gas.
Actually, that's right. But at the same time, I think there's less of a concern really about chemical weapons. There is some evidence that perhaps Gaddafi was considering using them in the early days. There were some reports that they've seen kind of gas masks and things like that. But he did destroy all of his ability to weaponize these, such as the warheads that he could use for these chemical weapons. They're believed to be stored in a very secure location in vats that the international community has been monitoring. So I think there's less a concern about mustard gas getting out than there is about these missiles that we've been talking about.
David.
I agree with Elise. I think that the focus of extreme concern right now are these shoulder-fired missiles, some of which could take down a commercial airliner.
There is a mitigating circumstance there, isn't there, though, which is that although Libya had all the missiles, it didn't actually have any of the launchers you need to shoot them from your shoulder. Now, of course, those could be obtained somewhere else in the world, and those missiles could still be a problem. But it's not as if the complete kit would have fallen into.
I see. All right. Let's talk about Iran and President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad condemning the violence in Syria. How unexpected is that, Edward?
Well, perhaps not unexpected, but horribly hypocritical. Obviously, Ahmadinejad presided over brutal repression of protesters in his own country. You do have to worry for Bashar al-Assad if even the president of Iran is telling him he's too mean to his own citizens. I mean, I think it betrays a sense from one of Syria's closest allies, a fear that things are getting a little bit out of control and that the outcome of these protests is not clear, and Iran sort of hedging its bets a little bit. But obviously, you don't look for humanitarian advice to Ahmadinejad.
I think that there's been a growing disillusionment with Iran's support for this this crackdown. Iran's, as much influence as it's believed to have in the region, I think that there's been a eroding support for Iran. And I think that it says two things. I think, A, as Ed said, it shows that Iran is very worried about what's happening. I think that Iran has an interest now in making sure that this situation calms down so it can continue to provide arms through Syria to Lebanon. It doesn't want to lose those proxies. Very important. Also, Iran is very nervous that Arab Spring is going to come knocking on its door.
And, of course, their much-delayed Russian-built nuclear power plant went online Saturday. David.
They began producing electricity at Bushehr, the plant that you referred to, Diane. There were other reports that a new generation of centrifuges, which in theory could enrich uranium much more quickly and get their uranium stockpiles up to the level of enrichment that would be needed for nuclear weapons, are being rushed into production. Further reports that at least some of those centrifuges may be taken to a hardened site near Qom, where they would be very difficult to bomb. This new generation presumably has different wiring than the earlier generation that was damaged substantially by the Stuxnet virus cyber attack several years ago that speeded up the centrifuges to the point that many of them cracked. This is a different generation, as I say, probably, almost certainly with different electronics. We'll see how they work.
But what about Iran's offer to allow inspectors or supervision, inspectors' supervision of their nuclear program, Edward?
Well, to me, it's hauntingly reminiscent of North Korea, right? You make offers, you step forward, you step back, you say, well, maybe, you know, when you feel under pressure. But, you know, the devil is obviously in the details. What, you know, what kind of supervision?
Supervision.
Well, and what does full supervision mean? Where would the inspectors be allowed to go? Would they be allowed, one of their complaints in the past, to interview the Iranian personnel involved in the nuclear program? You know, what kind of accounting of all the past questions that are outstanding would Iran give? You know, I think there's very little faith that Iran is somehow going to come clean about its nuclear program. After all, it still maintains quite implausibly at this stage that it has no interest in nuclear weapons and is only looking for atomic power. So the idea that somehow they've turned a corner, this is a new page, seems quite improbable to me.
And that's what the international community is saying. It's saying, listen, you already agreed to submit to these inspections. You're giving us 20% of what we're asking you to do, and you're already committed to doing it anyway. Basically, the Russians have been kind of giving Iran a little bit of pressure in recent months to come up with some kind of diplomatic initiative because it's losing all of this trade and commercial relationship. But at the same time that, you know, this is the first initiative in a long time, doesn't seem to be enough.
Elise Labbit, she's senior State Department producer for CNN, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Tell me about this brand new plan to keep 3,000 to 4,000 troops in Iraq, David, after the deadline for final withdrawal, which is December 31. That kind of came as something of a surprise to people.
I think it's less new than it seemed from the way that it's been disclosed this week. For a long time, the U.S. has been saying, really urging the Iraqis to think about some small residual presence of U.S. forces that would help with training. The Iraqis have said they'd like to buy F-16s, I think it is, for air defense, so you'd need American personnel there to do that. It's a small number of troops. The feeling, I think, on the U.S. side is that it would have a steadying effect in an Iraq that's awfully nervous. In terms of U.S. exposure, it's fairly limited. This is an administration that has as a top priority getting U.S. combat forces out of Iraq, and that's happened. So I think a small residual training force and a big combat force are not the same thing.
But how much tension might there be between the White House and the Department of Defense over this issue?
I think this reflects a little bit of tension, yeah. Diane. I think that the military, look, the commander of Iraq, U.S. forces in Iraq, General Lloyd Austin, had asked for, you know, tens of thousands of troops, maybe between 15,000 to 18,000. President Obama
to stay.
President Obama has said, I want to get all troops out. So this is believed to be some members of the military trying to make sure that at least the United States is going to keep some troops in there. The U.S. the military is eyeing a long-term presence. They don't want to leave Iraq because there is an interest in some kind of long-term strategic presence in Iraq. But at the same time, there's still talks going on with the Iraqis about what they need. They've said that they want trainers. What kind of trainers? How much are they going to need? How much does the U.S. think that they need? And at the same time, there are also concerns about this area in the north, Kirkuk, some of these areas still in dispute, that they're believed they might need to still be some patrols there. So I think that the number is out there as some kind of marker in terms of, we know we need to keep some kind of forces there. There's still going to be a lot of discussions inside the U.S. government and between the U.S. and the Iraqis about that final number. It's not set at all.
And exactly what constitutes that force. Edward, let's talk a little about India. Do we know who was responsible for Wednesday's bombing at the High Court?
There has been a claim of responsibility from a Kashmiri militant group. There was an email sent making that claim from a web cafe in Kashmir. The Indian authorities have arrested three people in Kashmir. It seems like they've basically arrested the owner of the web cafe and they're trying to figure out who sent the email. So it doesn't sound like they're really on top of the investigation, or at least not publicly so. But it also seems like a pretty good bet that an Islamic militant group from Kashmir was behind things.
Why does India continue to be so vulnerable to these kinds of attacks, David?
Well, it has a very large Muslim population. We forget that. And the Kashmir issue remains, in the eyes of many Kashmiri Muslims, unresolved. And so there's this kind of dry tinder. I think given the instability of Pakistan next door, you'd have to give the Indians pretty high marks for maintaining the amount of internal security that they do. These attacks were notable in part because they're unusual. Attacks of this
and
size
the
don't
problem
happen.
Is in part two, lack of metal detectors outside the courthouse, shortage of police, whole bunch of problems. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. 800-433-8850. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Visa, whose Visa Signature credit card offers access to the movies this summer. Details at fandango.com/visa-signature. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by American Jewish World Service, supporting local solutions to global challenges at ajws.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the Air Force's Bay State Winds Clarinet Quartet performs a couple of songs in tribute to the men and women who have served since 9/11. And NBC News chief foreign correspondent Richard Engel tells behind-the-scenes stories about his recent reporting from Libya, Egypt, and Afghanistan. Join us.
We're back. Time to open the phones now. First to Hickory, North Carolina. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. My question is, in light of the terror threat, is this the right time to use the profiling for citizens and security personnel to identify the potential threats? And I find it interesting that when someone uses the term Democrat, Diane becomes extremely outraged. But when liberals tell conservatives, son of a bitches, to go straight to...
Hey, thanks. I don't equate the two. Let's go to Big Rock, Illinois. Good morning, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, one of your panelists made the point about how Pakistan has provided arrests of three people or some new arrests, and I just get the feeling every time I hear this that it's they're playing us like a fiddle, both diplomatically, militarily, strategically, at every level, to keep the flow of the $8 to $11 billion, I think, somewhere in there, of aid that comes in. They'll just give us one every 3 months for 20 years. We're being played like a fiddle by Karzai in Afghanistan.
What do you think, Elise?
Well, I think that there is some truth to the idea that the Pakistanis are being selective about the kind of cooperation they want to give to the United States. And as David said, the relations have been poor for the last several months, and they knew that they had to help the United States to show that they're still on the same team. The truth of the matter is that, as we said, there are some terrorists that hurt Pakistan and they see an interest of going against them, and there are some that the U.S. wants the Pakistanis to go against. They're not always going to be the same, but the United States knows that this relationship is complicated, it's fraught with a lot of difficulty, but they know that they need the Pakistanis to continue to go after these terrorists. And as limited and as difficult as the cooperation is, they're going to stick with it. They have no choice.
Edward.
That's exactly right. I think, you know, maybe saying playing us like a fiddle is looking at it the wrong way. What if Pakistan, in spite of a lot of domestic opposition to its intelligence cooperation with the U.S., in spite of the unrest and terrorism and so on that it's faced with internally, what if it went ahead and cooperated with the U.S. And didn't get anything for it? Wouldn't Pakistanis be sitting there saying, well, America's playing us like a fiddle? You know, I mean, of course the relationship is like this. Both countries are looking out for their interests, and sometimes you know, one country or the other will feel like it's been messed around. But that's natural in international affairs.
Diane, I just wrote a novel on the subject of this fiddle playing called Blood Money. And I think one theme that comes through that and through my reporting is that this is what intelligence agencies do. I mean, we do have to remember that intelligence agencies, if you could do it in a straightforward way, non-deceitful way, you'd get some other agency of government to do it. So it's not surprising to me in the end that the ISI continues to operate in behalf of what it sees as its own interest, doesn't tell us everything. We're exactly the same with them. That's how intelligence agencies work.
Here's a posting on Facebook by Marianne, who says the Germans are not bailing out the Greeks, they're bailing out their own bankers. The banksters are doing to the Europeans what they successfully did to the Americans. What do you think of that, Edward?
Well, I think that's true. I think one of the striking things about the constant upheaval in the European financial sector is big banks across Europe, especially big German and French banks, countries that otherwise don't seem to be in as much trouble as some of the other countries in Europe, have huge exposure to the debt, the government debt of Greece, of Italy, of Spain. And so if Europe decided, all right, we'll just cut Greece off and we'll you know, let them deal with their own problems, that wouldn't work, because that creates huge problems then for the German banks and the French banks that lose an awful lot of money on those Greek bonds that they own. So the choice before Germany is really, do we bail out Greece via our own banks, or do we bail out Greece directly? But they can't ignore the problem altogether and think there'll be no repercussions for their own economies.
And Diane, I think that one of the things that is overlooked is this is one of the growing pains that the Europeans really didn't take into too much consideration when they created the European Union. I mean, everybody wanted this big political and trade entity that was going to be very powerful in the world, but it's like other international organizations where everybody has a burden. Some have to pick up some in some areas. Germany certainly enjoys the political clout that it carries from being such a big power in the European Union. It also, as one of the largest economies in the world, has to share the burden of the debt crisis.
And here's a listener tweet. Wasn't Libya supposed to get rid of all those chemical weapons when Bush normalized relations with them, David?
Part of the deal that brought Gaddafi back into the group of acceptable civilized nations was supposed to be the end of his WMD programs. including chemical weapons. As was noted earlier, they were quarantined. Some, I believe, were destroyed. But the question is what about the remaining ones? The fear was, up until about a week ago, that Gaddafi would use them on the rebels. I think now the fear is that Gaddafi's on the run. Are the rebels going to control these? The larger question that we're having to face up to is, who are the rebels? When we say they're going to be in control of all these Libyan weapons, who are they? Do we trust them? Do we have confidence that they'll use these in a responsible way?
All right, to Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning, Joe.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
If the Israelis get the bomb, the Iranians are going to want to get the bomb. Well, Israel has the bomb, so of course the Iranians are going to want to get the bomb. Is it viable for the United States to say, the Israelis are our friends, they're nice people, and wink at their bomb and try to get Iran not to go the same way? Thank you.
We've heard this question many times, Elise.
We've been doing that for years. We've been winking at the Israeli nuclear capability. So has the rest of the international community, and continued to go after states like Iran. The argument is that Israel is a democracy. Israel shares our kind of values. Israel is in a dangerous neighborhood, and they know how to be responsible. I mean, nobody's ever acknowledged Israel's nuclear program. There's always this creative ambiguity. But there, I think President Obama has made an effort to talk about, you know, the nuclear capability of all countries. You know, there's been talk about a nuclear-free Middle East zone. And even as unpopular as it is, the United States is saying, listen, let's get the Middle East cleaned up. Let's have some kind of peace agreement. Then we can try and convince Israel to sign up to this idea of a nuclear-free Middle East. Obviously, so much going on in the region right now that's kind of been put on the back burner.
David.
Well, I think the issue in terms of proliferation, I wish it was as simple as just Iran and Israel. The problem is that as Iran moves toward having nuclear weapons capability, it is now a certainty, it's been stated in public, that Saudi Arabia will move quickly to join Iran or to be able to combat and deter Iran. Egypt is likely to follow soon.
And you've already got India and Pakistan?
You have India and Pakistan as nuclear weapons powers that nearly came to war, we forget, within the last, 7 years. So we're heading toward a world in this crescent of crisis, this area of enormous instability, where in addition to everything else that's happening, you're going to have nuclear weapons proliferating. And that scares people. And I honestly don't hear from this administration a coherent strategy for dealing with this core problem.
All right. To Tom, who's in Hyattsville, Maryland. Good morning to you.
Yeah, good morning. I'm just following up a caller who raised a question about the weapons of mass destruction in Libya, and one of your guests, he responded by saying Libya was supposed to destroy them to join all the civilized nations. So does it mean these nations with these weapons are civilized? I mean, we have the weapons. Are we civilized?
It's a question I think many around the world are asking, that is, that the whole world is becoming weaponized in ways that could eventually destroy the planet, Edward.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we could all agree that the world would be a more civilized place, surely, if there were no weapons of mass destruction. I mean, I think if America ever found itself in a situation where it could with confidence abandon its weapons of mass destruction, that would obviously make the world a better place. But to somehow imagine that in a world that's uncertain as ours, with these problems of proliferation that David has just been talking about, America should sort of take the first step and do away with its weapons, it just seems to me to be a terrible mistake. So.
David, how would you say the world has changed since 9/11?
Wow, that's such a big question. We're all brooding about it in this week. My own quick answer is that September 11 forced the United States to understand in a new way that it couldn't be isolated from trends in the world, that there was a degree of anger and hostility in the world that we had not reckoned with. In reacting to that reality, I think we'd all agree we made mistakes. We overreacted. We got ourselves in deeper problems than we needed to. I would just note on the positive side, one thing that I've seen traveling to a lot of these war zones of the post 9/11 world over the last 10 years is how much our military has learned. And I don't mean in terms of learning how to kill people. I mean in terms of learning how to exist in other cultures, how to solve problems. You know, I wish other institutions of American society had learned as much about the world as the U.S. Army, which is much less ready today. If you ask top generals who are running our forces, they'll tell you, we have got to stop making enemies everywhere. We don't have enough bullets to kill all the enemies we're in danger of making. And I hope our politicians listen to what our military commanders, they don't want to fight more of these wars. They want to figure out ways not to.
Elise.
Well, I think that's largely true to some extent. I think that in terms of the Muslim world and how we found out after 9/11 that, quote unquote, they hate us, there's been this attention to try and change hearts and minds while not really addressing the kind of problems in this world that create the kind of extremism that we see, the anger towards the United States. And it's not just directed towards the United States anymore. It's directed towards all Western nations, even Muslim nations that don't espouse these ideologies. And so I think that we've really not done a good job in terms of combating extremism, so to speak. But we've also seen around the world, 9/11 might have changed the world, but there are other things that have changed the world just as much. If you look at what's happening in the Arab world with the Arab Spring right now, this kind of extremist ideology is not what people are looking for. They're looking for the kind of democratic freedom type of values that America espoused. So even as I think people don't hate America, they hate American policies. And we still haven't been able to address that one area.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Edward, what's your view?
Well, I'm struck by how much these days, obviously we're talking about 9/11 a huge amount because of the anniversary, and obviously we're still embroiled in Iraq and Afghanistan and we're still taking off our shoes at airports. You know, we're conscious of very much of the ways in which 9/11 has changed our lives. But I would say that nowadays the average American is feeling much more the impact of the financial crisis and the collapse in the housing market and the recession and the huge level of unemployment and so on, which, you know, can't be laid at the feet of 9/11. I think we've got a fresh crisis now that in a strange way has superseded 9/11, and that seems to me the most urgent task at hand, and one that which to be fair we're all concentrating on now.
And
more.
I keep wondering whether anyone sees any connection between 9/11 and the financial crisis we currently face. David?
This will sound awfully abstract, but I think one thing that we've learned in the last 10 years is that our systems are not automatically self-correcting, that our political system gets a shock like 9/11, and rather than coming back to the center and sort of balance, it becomes more unstable. And the same has been true of our economic system. Free market economies are supposed to be self-correcting. You know, bubbles develop, prices and interest rates are supposed to equilibrate to bring the bubble. That hasn't happened. And so I think, you know, we live in a world where problems just get worse and worse. They're not damped. And I think one thing for wise political leaders to think about is, in each of these spheres, how do we get better control, sensible, rational controls to keep the economy from being so dangerous, to keep our commitments overseas from being so ruinous as they've been in this case?
I think, Diane, one thing we saw after 9/11, and we've been talking about it this week, which is really kind of reminded me of the spirit after 9/11, not just in the country, but around the world. There was this kind of goodwill and everybody was willing to work together in terms of solving the immediate problems at hand. And isn't it interesting as those years fade, as David said, we have a crisis, we try to solve it, and then we kind of forget. And there's not that kind of spirit in terms of working together to solve these problems of the international community. And most particularly, we're seeing these domestic political battles at home. We're having a real crisis in this country, and you don't seem to kind of have this spirit of let's work together, let's help solve the problems for the America and the world
and
in this country.
And the question is 9/11 in some way connected to that lack of, I mean, around the world, I realize we have lost a certain respect. We've lost a certain sense of superiority. But in some way, is all of this connected? And it's a question for which I'm sure there are millions of answers. But I want to thank you all for being here this morning.
Thank you.
David Ignatius, Elise Labatt, Edward McBride. Thank you all for listening. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.